Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and a very warm welcome to this, the second of the lecture series we're holding to accompany the launch of the Young Foundation. I hope you have all found a comfortable seat for this evening. You will have received, I hope, a short leaflet on what the Young Foundation is, why we're here, why we're launching, so I won't repeat any of that. Can I just urge any of you who are academics, though please don't leave without taking one of these leaflets, which you have an incentive to take because it's about a new prize we are launching with the ESRC, which I hope there might be someone eligible for here. And also, if you're interested in social change of any kind, please have a look at this book, which we've just reprinted, Young at 80, about Michael Young, and an extremely good account of how to actually achieve practical change in all sorts of ways. Very readable as well, and available at the bargain price of £9.99 outside the door, along with some of Tariq's books as well. Those of you who were here a week ago for the lecture by Charles Tilley, well, I hope have enjoyed it. It was a fascinating session, and I hope, like tonight, our intention in holding it was very much to promote understanding and insight, not rhetoric. We're looking for light rather than heat, and I'm sure that's what we're going to get this evening as well. And we're really delighted that Tariq was willing to come and give one of these lectures for us. I think he's now become, this year, since we arranged this lecture, much better known to many people in this country. He is, one of the outstanding thinkers of the modern world, and we are convinced he will have a very major and positive influence on this country in the years ahead as he's becoming more and more based over here. And I'm also delighted that Sukhvinder Stubbs, who is chairing this evening, has agreed to do so. She is director of the Barrow Cadbury Trust, but probably many of you won't be aware of what an important role she has played in the last 5 or 10 years in promoting understanding of Islam, combating Islamophobia, both in her current role and before that at the Runnymede Trust. So without further ado, the LSE clock says it's 3:25 in the afternoon, which probably means it's time to start and for me to hand over to Sukhvinder. Thank you.
Well, good evening, folks. I'm glad to see a full house here tonight, and quite right, too. It's very much credit to our speaker tonight, and I'm looking forward to hearing what he has to say to us. There have been a couple of occasions now where Professor Tariq Ramadan and I have found ourselves together, and he's been challenging each time, and I'm sure it'll be no different tonight. Perhaps just before I introduce him and hand over to him, perhaps it's just worth saying that I'm actually a Sikh from the Punjab region of India, and born just very near the border with Pakistan. And had I been born just about 50 miles or so to the north, I would very probably have been a Muslim. And I believe that Muslims and Sikhs have a great deal in common, not least in their spiritualism and regard for values seemingly long lost in secular society. Certainly amongst the ethnic minority communities in Britain, Islam has now gained prominence, with Muslims making up a third or so of the ethnic minority population, and the emphasis on religion posing serious questions to our approach to integration and community cohesion. So very much looking forward to hearing what Professor Tariq Ramadan has to say. I think that awkward negotiations between people of good faith undoubtedly lie ahead, and we need all the mediators we can get. Professor Tariq Ramadan is visiting fellow at St. Anthony's College and senior research fellow at the Lokahi Foundation. And I think we very much look forward to the challenges that he will pose for us this evening. So over to you, Professor. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for this introduction, and thank you for this invitation. I want to thank the Young Foundation for this invitation. We spoke about it. It was a few months ago before what happened in this country. And I think that it's much more relevant for us to speak about this and of course, the place of Islam in non-Islamic societies. So as we don't have too much time, it's a very complex issue, a very complex problem that we have trying to just not to solve, but at least to understand, and in which way, for now and the future, the Muslims and the Muslim Europeans and the European Muslims are going to be part of and are already part of the European society, and in which way they can not only be perceived as a problem, but as an asset, a richness, a wealth for at the religious level, the social level, and the cultural level in these countries, and these countries are now our countries. So let me first start with a short introduction. Not so short, in fact. I have always long introduction. So I will try to be as short as possible to speak about four main remarks, starting the discussion about, you know, the place of Islam in non-Islamic society. And then two parts, which is when we are dealing with these kind of issues, we really need to speak about the theoretical approach, which is really important. It's not only to go straight to practical issues, but we have here, we are dealing with references, with principles, with religious tradition, as we are speaking about Islam, and I really think that we need to understand that we have to deal with the Islamic tradition per se, as we are speaking about the religious the Islamic presence and the Muslim presence in the West, and then to practical issues. This will be the second part, and try to go through some of the challenges we are facing and in which way we can solve them, and then to end with our shared responsibilities. Because when we speak about the European Muslim citizens, it's very often that we are speaking about, yes, okay, we are speaking with Muslims and you have to solve the problems. Yes, there will be no solutions as to the Muslim presence without the Muslims. But the Muslims are not the only one who are able to come, and they are necessary to come together to give solutions. So if we speak about this presence, we really need to understand that we need partnerships, we need to work together, and we need this kind of mutual understanding, and starting from mutual respect. So very quickly, the introduction, four main points. You know, when you read the sociologists and the political experts, very often they say, okay, look, for Muslims, it's a really new reality, because being a minority in a non-Islamic society or a non-Islamic majority society is something which is new. It's wrong. It's as old as the Islamic history to find Muslims as a minority in non-majority Islamic society. So it's not new. It's very old. And if, you know, it's not because it's coming now during the last few decades, and mainly after the Second World War, that we can say, okay, it's a new problem, it's a new... No, it's not new, it's very old, and just think about the Muslims in many countries in Africa, Western Africa, or in India, for example. They are in minority, and they are dealing with the problem dealing with the problem for the last few centuries, and of course, even in Spain before that, in the Middle Ages. So what is new, in fact, is the place of Muslims in secular societies, where religion has a specific role and a specific place after, you know, what happened during the Enlightenment and what we are dealing with now, where we are speaking about two different spheres and places and spheres when we say, okay, religion is a private matter, it's for the private life, and that we have, you know, the state and the public life is a space where this is a neutral space. So, and we are dealing here with a rule of law. So rule of law is not something which is new for the Islamic tradition, but secular, you know, organization is something which is new. So it's a new perception in which way, as Muslims living in a secular society, we are dealing with the public sphere and the private sphere. This is new, and not the fact to be a minority. And it's very important to understand that. Why? Because, yes, the great majority of what was produced by the Islamic classical tradition in fiqh, so the jurisprudence, law and jurisprudence, Islamic law and jurisprudence, was of course, you know, a perception of, you know, an Islamic majority society. But not always, and we have many, many things coming from scholars during the ages speaking about the reality of being a minority. The second point, which is really also very obvious for many people when we speak about Islam, is there is a problem, and the Muslims are not integrable, or they are not able to integrate, or able to adapt themselves to this reality of a secular society. Why? Because in Islam there is no difference between religion and politics. And we are speaking like that. And Muslims are even very often repeating that. And at the same time, we have Orientalists. So they are nurturing each other, saying, we don't make a difference, which is, in fact, not because of a modern thought, but it's as old as Islam and the Islamic classical science within the fiqh realm, that we are making a difference between two different spheres. When we are dealing with God, we are dealing according what are the rules of the ibadat, worship, which is you can do but what is written. So it's a very non-rationalistic way to deal with the text. So in order to pray, you have to come with a text to tell me how I can pray. So this is the sphere of revelation and dogma, not a revelation with, you know, understood through the rational process. But when we deal with mu'amalat, social affairs, the methodology is exactly the opposite. Everything is possible, but what is prohibited. So it's exactly the opposite methodology. So we have here a field of creativity, rationality, everything is open. Al-aslu fil ashiya al-ibaha, we say in Arabic, which is the principle in everything here is permission. So to tell me that it's not possible, you have to come with a text telling me it's prohibited. So it's exactly the opposite of the text of worship, where here you have to come with a text to tell me that it's possible. So you have two opposite, contradictory methodologies for two fields, where there is one where there is a great deal of creativity and the other one is just do what is written. And this is really important. Why? Because from the very beginning, the scholars understood that, saying that in the realm of permission, I can take everything which is good, coming from whatever, from wherever and from whoever is coming with it. So this is really important, not to come with simplistic statements. The Muslims are just, it's exactly the same. The sources are the same, but the methodologies and the way we are dealing with two different realms are different. So it's really important to understand that this is as old as Islam. Now you can tell me that some trends and some scholars and some schools of law are confusing between both, and you are right. But it's not because some are confusing that all are confusing. So it's something which is to be understood as a very complex intra-discussion among Muslims, which is, once again, to understand that we are not dealing with a monolithical reality. Islam is that. And for example, we have here the place of Islam, which is the right way to put it, would have been the place of Muslims. There is one Islam, but there are Muslims. And when, once again, very quickly, between brackets, something which is really important here is that when we speak about Islam, don't put an S to Islam just to show to the people that you have understand how complex it is. Because you're just putting an S. No, there is one Islam because all the Muslims throughout the world are believing in the same set of principles. They pray the same, they believe in the same principles. This is one Islam. Now, we have different readings of the sources, so we have different interpretations. People have exactly believe in the same set of principles, one Islam, different interpretations, and then we have also different cultures. So we have layers of diversity, and not only. And it's not by putting S that you have understood the difference between the Salafi and the Sufi and the reformist and the rationalist and the radical. You cannot understand that by putting an S to Islam. Okay, and you are not going to understand the difference between the African Islamic culture and the Asian Islamic culture. And by the way, there is not only one Islamic Asian culture, but Islamic Asian cultures. So it's much more complex. Then you are lost. So it's the beginning of our mutual respect. If you respect the complexity of the other, you are starting to be respectful towards who he is and the reality from where he comes or she comes. So here we are dealing with something which is really important to understand. So the point here is that because we have this simplistic statement, the Muslims are putting everything together, politics, religion, everything is one. so they are not integrable in our society, because in this society we are making differences. We know the different spheres. So by the way, we have very often a very simplistic perception of our own society. So someone saying that there is no relationship in our society between the public sphere and religions. Do you believe that this is true? It's wrong. Even in France, the relationship between something which is an old religious tradition and the way we are organizing the public sphere. Of course there is a relationship. So it's more complex for the European societies, and it's more complex for the Muslims. And I really think that we have to understand each other through this, reconcile ourselves with complexity, with this intrinsic complexity of the two worlds. So out of this perception, there are implicit messages coming, bringing to the fore, and I think that we have to come to this, and this is the third remark of this short, as I told you, introduction. So the first is that it's as if we are living with we are facing two closed universes. So Islam on one side and the West on the other side, it's as if we have monolithical realities and closed realities, and at the same time, just it's two realities and at the same time conflicting realities. And the three words are wrong. They are not closed realities and closed universes. They are not monolithical realities. And we have movement and differences. And they are not conflicting realities. There are as many things within the old Islamic tradition coming from the West as there is in the West things coming from the Islamic classical, you know, tradition or history. Islamic philosophy and Islamic legal tradition. So I think that it's really important upstream from the discussion to get rid of this, you know, binary vision, closed reality, two universes. And no, because we are coming from this perception that Islam is this and the West is that. And I think that, once again, this is wrong. The third and the fourth and last one, I think that it's really important to understand that if we want to solve the problems we are dealing with today, there is something which is a statement, and I take it as a starting point. Solutions are coming from within the tradition. So to deal with Muslims, it's really important to understand that if you want to find solutions for Muslims today, you should come back to the Islamic tradition and work from within. So it's from within that you will, it's not as an outsider or speaking from outside as a Muslim that you will are going to, it's not coming from our perception that you are speaking from outside that you will find a solution. So it's really important to be rooted in the deep old Islamic tradition to help the people to move from that reality, to understand the new challenges, the new contemporary challenges we are dealing with, that we will find the solutions. And once again, it doesn't mean that it's only from within, doesn't mean that it will be without the other, without the non-Muslims. No, from within, but with this dialectical process, dialogue between the intrinsic reality of the tradition with the environment and the people who are asking the questions. So my point here as to finding solutions for the future is to understand that every question is legitimate, coming from every mind, that it's really important. And the Muslims should understand that. Every question is legitimate. As long, of course, it's based on good faith, that you are just trying to try and find solutions, that not you are trying to play and to manipulate. But a question is legit. Anything, it's because it helps you to understand your own tradition and to come to new answers for new kind of problem. That's it. So these are the four main remarks. And I think that with this mindset, we are able to come to something which is, okay, now we have to deal with the theoretical frame out of this understanding that it's a complex reality and that we have to deal with something which is not going to be easy. And as I said, rooted in the Islamic tradition to try to come with which kind of theoretical framework we can provide the Muslim with in order to help this process to occur and to help them to understand that it's possible to solve this sometimes perceived as an impossible equation, being a Muslim and being a European at the same time, or being or living in a non-Islamic majority society. The first thing I want to say upstream from the theoretical framework, which is really important for me, is to say something which is obvious when you are sitting here. It's not obvious when you are dealing with Muslims or Muslims are dealing with their own society. What we want is clearly that, to be able to be at the same time both fully Muslim and fully European or American or Canadian or Australian in a non-Islamic majority society, or an African, for example, in African society. This is what we want. It means that for the Muslims, they are not asked to be less Muslims, to be more Europeans. And for our fellow citizens, don't expect from the Muslims to be less Muslims in order to prove you that they are more Europeans. The challenge is both at the same time. It means that we are dealing here with something that we all have to understand. We don't have only one closed identity. We have multiple identities and moving identities. Moving identities. Now, you are not the same as you were 30 years ago for those who are more than that. And for the other, you are going to change. But every one of us is changing. And it's really important to understand that we have a moving identity. It's moving, but multiple identity. And this is why, from the very beginning, we have to be clear. Not less Muslim to be more European, not more less European to be more Muslim, not less European to be more Muslim. It's really important for the Muslims to understand that the more I'm against the West, the more I'm Muslim. No, this is wrong. You can be against the West and be very, very, very weak in the way you are belonging to the Islamic tradition. It doesn't mean that to be against the West means that you are more Muslim, and it doesn't mean that to be a Muslim you are going at the same time to forget about, or to be a European to forget about your Islamic principles and tradition. So here this is something which is really important, and to get rid of one question which is a wrong question from the starting point of our discussion. When you ask the people, and this was a question I heard, I don't know, so many times since July the 7th, and this was the case in other countries before that. Look, tell me, are you first a Muslim or British? It's a wrong question leading you to give wrong answers. If you are speaking about my philosophy of life, I'm a Muslim with a Swiss passport. Okay? But if you are asking me to give you through my passport the meaning of my life, it will be very difficult. This is one. The second, if you are asking me about my involvement in my society, I'm a Swiss. I'm a Swiss citizen, and I'm struggling and acting and participating as a Swiss. I'm Swiss first in that field with a Muslim background. Is that wrong? It depends on the field you are speaking about. And every one of you is doing that. You are an atheist, a Marxist, a Christian, a Jew, a Buddhist, when we speak about your philosophy of life, with a British passport. But when we are speaking about dealing with politics, you are a British, and we will speak about your philosophical background another time. That's it. So the point is summarized by the Nobel Prize of Economy, taking a very simple image I like. So look, if you go to a party with poets, okay, or you go to eat with vegetarians, and think that you are a poet and at the same time a vegetarian. If you go to eat, it will be the wrong answer when you are asked, what are you going to eat, to say, I'm a poet. It will be the wrong answer in a party with poets to say, I am a vegetarian. It depends where you are. That's it. It's as simple as that. But because we have this very wrong question in our mind, tell me who you are first, we are leading the people to say, okay, I want to show you that I am a Muslim first and not a British. By pushing them in that sense, in that direction, you are pushing this, you are just nurturing this kind of reaction. So it's a question of psychology here. It's not a question of the right answers, because your question was wrong. So the point here, we get rid of this question. Please forget about it and come to the deep challenges we are facing. So here we are facing with something which is really important when we speak about this presence is, for us, When we deal about Islam and Muslims in a non-Islamic society, it's really important to come to the something which is the meaning of being a Muslim. And here we have a challenge. You can come in a non-Islamic society and say, okay, I am a minority, I am not really in a society where the people are like me, and you are nurturing two things in you. The first one is the sense of being a minority, and you are nurturing, I am a minority versus a majority. And then what can come from that is something which is the victim mentality. I am a minority protecting myself from a majority. The only way to solve the problem for all the Muslims living in a non-Islamic society or perceived like this, not Islamic majority society, is to come back to the universality of Islam and the universal principles. This is the starting point of the discussion. So to come to the meaning of, for example, for Muslim Tawheed, there is one God for all the humanity. So you are my brother in humanity. To come back to the essential, not the perception that I'm trying to protect myself. Come to the essential principles, the fundamentals. And why we are starting with the Tawheed, and all the Muslims will agree on that. And the second is all these values that we are promoting, justice, equality, and human brotherhood. So when you come to that, you understand that the principles could integrate the reality of the other. The problem we have with the Muslim mentality today is the confusion we have between principles and models. And be careful, this is a very important point. And very often when we deal deep down with the Muslim perception of who they are confusing a model of society with the universal principles of Islam. So it means two things. For their personal life, for them to remain a Muslim in Britain is going to mean, deep in their mind, to remain a Muslim as we were Muslim in Pakistan, in Turkey, in the countries of origin. So the model of being a Muslim there becomes the only reality. So they are confusing something which is a historical context with universal principles. And this is something that we have to do, which is differentiating between the cultures that are contextual and the principles that are universal. This is one. It's not easy. I'm not saying it's here, sitting down and say, oh, yeah, yes, I follow you. You can follow me here, and sometimes in your personal life you don't follow at all, because it's really difficult. So, okay, when we are dealing with your own father and your own mother coming from the countries of origin, it's very difficult because they are saying, this is Islam. No, this is the Pakistani way to think about being a Muslim. So start the discussion, and sometimes you cannot just end it. It's difficult. So this is one. The second is when we are dealing with societies. For Muslims, they are looking to looking at the history of Islam. The Islamic history through this, we have models of society. So the only way to remain Muslim is just to import the models of society and forgetting that these societies were based on principles. So we have to extract from the historical realities the principles and not to try to duplicate or to import the models. Why? Because the models are historical and the principles are universal. And the very important point here is the way the Muslims are very often, and some groups here in this country are speaking about the Medinian period. Say, this is exactly what we have to do. Just follow the Prophet of Islam, peace be upon him, just take the model and just do it now. If we were to try to just to implement this model the neighborhood of London, you're not going to succeed. Because it's not possible to import a historical model from one time to another. So you are totally misled if you think like that. But what you have to do is to study what was done at this time to extract the principles that you want to remain faithful to in your time, not to export or import the models. So to come here is, if you import the models is just excluding the other. The principles are inviting the other. Because out of the principle, say, okay, I have the same principle of justice as you. Maybe my historical experiences or the experiences of Muslims throughout history are not the same. The principles are the same and not the experience model. But if we put in the front of the discussion the models, it's the conflict. If we put the principles, is the common good. It's the common realities that you can find. So here we have a very deep problem. And it means, which is, you can do it out of confidence. You know, this is why I'm saying that the most important problem we have today in the non-majority Islamic society, it's not a question of law, it's not a question of principles, it's a question of confidence and perceptions. If you are not self-confident that you have universal value and you can build on that, you just perceive the other and you are defining yourself against the other. So I'm protecting myself. You're not building with the other, just protecting. And this is something that we have to acknowledge as Muslims. This is the reality of the Islamic history during the last 10 centuries. Starting on the 13th century when the Muslims had the perception that they were in minority. So they are protecting themselves, not coming from, okay, look, this is a universal message and you can build on it. And out of confidence, we can come to distinguishing between principles and models. And this is really important to do because on that we can integrate from the other. Having said that, I'm coming to something which is a theoretical discussion around one concept that you see in the media. You are maybe sometimes using it and maybe not understanding exactly what it means, which is the concept of Sharia. And here we have a problem. The most sophisticated minds in the West just want to show sometimes that they don't understand, that it's much more complex than that. Say, okay, no, it's not the penal code. And they are right. But they just define it as the Islamic law, the sacred Islamic law. And it's not the only definition. This definition is coming from the fuqaha, the jurists from the Islamic tradition. But from the very beginning, we have the understanding that Sharia is much broader than that. It's a comprehensive concept, which is the way towards faithfulness. It's at the same time the spiritual path, it's the legal path, it's the social path where you are trying through history to remain faithful to the source, the way towards the beginning. The way towards the source, which is the literal meaning of Sharia. It's not the penal code. It's to be consistent with your own values where you are trying to live in your time. And you are trying to find legal framework, you are trying to find spiritual teaching in order to be consistent. So if you reduce Sharia to law, it's as if, okay, we implement the law, and if you have a dogmatic approach, it's just implement the law and this is Islam, which is wrong. If you add to that the perception that we have conflicting models, it's just the model of Sharia is against the Western model, it's just the wrong way to deal with the concept. Now we have two things to say. If you will not succeed in the Islamic world if you are going to remove Islamic terminology. What is really important is to give them a deep definition, but not to remove them. The people who are saying, we don't want you to use the concept of jihad, are wrong. Jihad is a central concept in Islam. Now the point is which definition you give to the concept. But don't try to remove, because if you try to remove, the people are perceiving that you try to betray and to change. But if you come with new definition from within, deep in the Islamic tradition, rooted in the Islamic tradition, they can listen. So we have to come with that. So the concept of Sharia is the path towards faithfulness, dealing with the principles in order to find a way to implement new models in order to remain faithful. New models to remain faithful. By this definition, I am saying one thing which is essential. No faithfulness without evolution. The true faithfulness is not status quo, it's evolved. You have, this is your responsibility. And you know why? This is exactly the methodology of social affairs, creativity and rationality. Try to find new way. New way to implement, because in new reality, we need new ways to implement in order to be faithful to the principles. Because the principles implemented literally in a new context could be a betrayal of the spirit of the principles, the principle itself. So this is something that we have to come with as an understanding. And it means here that if we come to the universal justice, and this is what we have to build, this is what I want you to understand when we speak about Muslims here, we need this kind of discussion. We don't have to come, we cannot come with simplistic answers to deep questions. This is the kind of answers the Muslims are looking for. Come with something which is rooted in my tradition. I don't want to betray that. This is me. So don't come with something and say, okay, be a citizen, don't care. Okay, I don't care. I'm not going to care about citizenship if I'm betraying my heart. This is the perception. We are dealing here with something which is very deep in the Muslim contemporary conscience. It's really deep. The Muslim mind needs this kind of answer. So the point for me is to come from within, say, okay, we have this definition which is needed, a new perception of the concept, and then we have to speak about legislation. Some Muslims, confusing between principles and models, say, okay, we have something which is a model of Islamic society, a structure, and very often they reduce that to Islamic State. So the Islamic State is exactly the opposite of the Western State. So we have, once again, conflicting models. No discussion. It's conflict. If you come to principle, say, this is wrong. The way you are putting it is misleading all the Muslims who are following you. What we need now is to remain faithful to principles of justice. So now I am in Britain. When a law in this country is just, it's part of me because it's promoting here my way towards faithfulness. So it's part of my Sharia. When I'm dealing in this country with law saying equal citizenship, equal rights for the law, this is me. This is my way. So don't put in my mind a model which is conflicting this model. No, forget about this. Come with principles. What is done here in the name of a very old rationalist tradition is not against me, because what is coming from the Muslim mind is not it's not against what is coming from the divine book. If I'm serious about it, there is no conflicting approach. So a principle implemented in a country coming from a rationalist viewpoint but promoting justice is mine. I am taking it. You know how we call that? The principle of integration, meaning everything which is good is yours. Okay? Very simply put, when we discuss, I'm talking now with a non-Muslim, everything you say which is good is mine. Okay? I'm integrating what you are saying. It's good, it's me. Now, what everything you say which is wrong or bad is yours. Take it for you. That's it. You know, when you come with this principle of universality, you take, you integrate. This is the universal principle of integration. And this should be put in our minds. This is the perception of a new perception of reality, not coming as, you know, scared Muslims, but confident Muslims with a universal message taking from whoever is thinking. So I'm here. All the laws in this country promoting equality, justice, and as a citizen, I will speak about this later, as a citizen, I will have a critical mind when I think that there is a discrepancy between the, you know, the ideal of the law and the way it's implemented, because we have this problem. You know, very often the people, and this is something which is very wrong in the way we discuss together, sometimes the people are, you know, using their own, they are referring to their ideal and criticizing the reality of the other. So, you know, democracy is great. Look at your societies. And the Muslims are doing exactly the same. Oh, Islam is great. Look at your society. So they are comparing their ideals with the reality of the others, and the West is doing exactly the same. Let us be critical in the way we have to deal with our own discrepancies. My point is not the ideals you promote. It's the way they are implemented. And here is the problem. You know, you are telling me, and this is I'm always saying that to Muslims, you are telling me that there is no problem in Islam as to women. And I agree with that. Islam has no problem with women. But Muslims have. Muslims have. There is a difference between the ideal and what you are doing. So come to the reality. Don't speak about the ideals just to avoid the questions. And in the West, yes, democracy is great. Are you sure that what we are living in now is the ideal of democratic process? You have some doubt? Me too. That's right. We have to be critical. And by saying that I'm not non-loyal to my Swiss country, it's because I am like this that I am showing that I'm loyal to my country. Critical mind is not to be unloyal. It's to be loyal. A true citizen is the one who is critical. Because of the values and the principles we are promoting. It's not just to, as a Muslim, I'm scared for you, you know, you to think that I'm not really loyal to my country. Say, okay, everything is fine. This is the best society I live in. It's strong. So critical mind is needed. So here the point, very quickly, is to come with this integrative process. the principle of integration of the law and say, okay, there is no models that are conflicting, but principles that we are promoting, and deep upstream from the discussion to come with this perception. And the point here is also that we are dealing with cultures. You know, there is one experience I'm always doing with the majority Muslims in this country, in Britain, because they are coming from the Asian, Bengali and Pakistani. And I use a very simple sentence. Okay, look, the Arabic language is the language of Islam. Of course, for the Muslim, it's that. But the Arabic cultures are not the cultures of Islam. Oh, yes, the Asian are very happy. That's it. You're right. Of course, they are coming from the Asian culture. And say, well, okay, look, you know what you are doing with the British culture exactly like the Arabs are doing with the Asian culture. They are looking down to, you know, the Asian. What? No, they are not really Muslims. You know, they have to come to Arabize themselves a bit, which is wrong. But the point is that the Asian, coming from the Asian countries, have the perception that everything which is coming from the British culture is less Islamic than theirs. So they are doing towards the British culture exactly like the Arabs are doing with the Asian. And now they start to listen. Look, not everything which is coming from the Asian culture is Islamic, isn't it? It's not. And not everything coming, you know, I'm coming from Egypt, not everything coming from my Egyptian culture is Islamic. Many things are even against Islam. The point here is to look at the British culture and to look with and through this window of integrating what is good. Because many things in the British culture are more Islamic than what you find in the Pakistani, the Egyptian, the Syrian, or the Arab cultures. Many things, if only you study, if only you know. So if we come back to the principle, everything which is good is yours, everything in this culture which is good is yours. So you are British by culture and Muslim by religion. Nothing wrong with that. And this is the future. We are going towards a British Islamic culture as a British or a French Islamic culture. And very often I use a European Islamic culture. But by the way, if now you take a British Muslim born in this country and you bring him or her to France and you try to start a discussion with a French Muslim, a born French Muslim, you will see exactly the same differences between the British and the French. They are Muslims, but they don't share the same cultures. So we have cultures in Europe and not only one. So the difference are here. We are rooted in specific and we have to change this perception. It means that out of all discussion, there is not only one integration. There is many integration. There is something which is a religious and legal integration when you are dealing with principles. This is one. There is something which has nothing to do with Islam, by the way, which is a social integration. The problem in these countries now that Muslims and non-Muslims together are confusing all the spheres. They come with religious problems to solve social problems. It has nothing to do with that. We have, from the very beginning, to de-Islamize the social problems and political problems in our countries. It has nothing to do with religion. These are social problems to be dealt with through a social procedure or social policies. But to come always to confuse that, the Muslims are doing the same mistakes. Very often they put too much emphasis on the religious belonging to try to solve social problems. It has nothing to do with that. So we have something which is a social integration, an intellectual integration as well, when you deal with culture and things. And there is something which is, for me, encompassing all that, which is the highest level of integration. Many people are asking the Muslim, forgetting, at the same time they are forgetting the recent history that, you know, we are now dealing with third, fourth, and fifth generation of Muslims. We are still telling them, okay, are you starting to integrate now? We are forgetting about their fathers and their mothers. And still, in the French, for example, discussion, and here even, we are speaking about the British immigrants or the French immigrants. They are coming from, we are confusing immigration with citizenship and being a British or being a French. And we know, if we just study history, that the difference between an indigenous British citizen and a new or an immigrant British citizen is that we are all immigrants. The only difference that you are older immigrant than me, that's it. It's a question of time. So the point here is really sensitive. It's just we are dealing with something with that. In your mind, in your perception, I'm not really already a British or a European. I have to prove it. But the proof is here. We have millions now of European. You know, it's as if around the discussion about Turkey, is it possible for these people there to become really Europeans? And we are here ourselves, European citizens. Okay, are you not forgetting us? We are already Europeans. Millions are already. And you are speaking about these Turkish Muslim people as if they were outside the realm of Europe, because Europe is what exactly? A Christian group, a Christian team, what? Or a non-Islamic team in your mind. So the problem is a problem of perception here. And what is beyond all that is something which is, for me, the psychological integration. Not the social only, not the intellectual, not the religious. Psychological. And you know what it means, psychological integration? It's not the way we put it to Muslims today. You have to integrate. It's the way we should try to deal with Muslims. You Muslims should integrate the European reality as yours. It's home. You understand? It's exactly the opposite process. You have to integrate this society because it's yours. This culture is yours. These domestic policies are yours. Integrate and not only accept the way it's put. You have to integrate. And you know, my point with Muslims is very often the problem is the way you are asked. So the only thing you have to do is to listen to the question and to rephrase the question. It's not, I am integrating, I am to be integrated, I am integrating in my own psychology the fact that this is my country. So it's a very important point. So here we are dealing with theory, and it's out of all this discussion that we have to deal with identity. As I said, multiple identity and moving identity. Belonging. I belong to this country. This is my country, and I respect the constitution. I respect here, you don't have one, but we have the legal framework and this. Yes. Okay, the point here is that you are taking from, so you are dealing with belonging, loyalty. So loyalty is not blind following, it's critical mind, is to be part of the society, to be critical, to disagree with the government, to be able to say that I disagree and not to be put, you know, to be suspected of not real loyalty. And to tell you the truth, don't forget one thing, which is for me essential if we are all against any kind of racism. We are all here, and we have to say that anti-Semitism is not acceptable, and what was done in this continent was not acceptable. But what was said about the Jews in this country? Double talk, not loyal, and belonging to something which is an international conspiracy. Look at what you have now about the Muslims. Double talk, we can't trust you. Double talk, we can't trust you. Second, you have a hidden agenda, you are not loyal. No loyalty possible. You have a double agenda. And you are dealing with an international conspiracy. You are the fifth column. Exactly the same perception coming with the same old racism, which is what we are not accepting altogether. And we have to be careful not just only to come with old things that are building our perception. So quickly now to the few points about the... Am I still... Yes, it's okay. That's great. The last time we were together, she had to cut me straight. So here, it's really important to come to... Now, out of this, so it's through this perception that I think that we have to speak about the concept of identity, which is essential. This is what I was trying to do in To Be a European Muslim, and then to the last book, Western Muslims and the Future of Islam, belonging to belong to your country and loyal to your country. It's not a problem as Muslims. If we come with this perception, we can come with answers that are rooted in the Islamic tradition, helping us to understand that loyalty, belonging, identity are concepts that we are building through a dynamic process, a better understanding of the overall and comprehensive concept of Sharia and dealing with this country as ours. Now, the practical issues, and I just few things about what we have to do and what is necessary and what are the problems. We have a problem with the Islamic education, not only in the West or the non-Islamic countries. But if we want to be consistent with what all I said and saying that, you know, the Islamic, the Muslim intelligence and understanding is something that, as you understood it, I hope from this first part, is a dialectical process between text and context, the text and the environment, the principles and the way you implement them according and the way you are integrating the principle. It's a dialectical process. We understand that. If we are serious and consistent with this main point, and by the way, when I'm saying that, I'm representing in the Islamic landscape something which is at the same time, you can find people coming from the reformist tradition, coming from the Sufi tradition, the rationalist tradition, but not the literalist tradition. The literalist tradition are going to say, this is not Islam. He's outside. And this is why we need an intra-community dialogue, because here we don't agree. For example, very often the problem I have with some literalists is that they are taking the methodology of al-ibadat, the way we are dealing with God, in the way we are dealing with human beings, and say this is not right, but this is a discussion that is needed. But you have to understand that I am not representing all the Muslims, and that some Muslims, sometimes they are listening to me and say, okay, he's lost. It's true. It's true that I'm, for them, it's not the way. It's just modernizing Islam, westernizing Islam. I'm always facing this reality, too much Muslim for the Westerners and too much Westerner for the Muslims, for some Muslims. But this is the reality. And I think it's the only way to build bridges. And my point is, my obsession, so to say, is just to remain consistent and at the same time, as I said, Muslim and European. And I think that it's possible. If we are serious about that through the dialectical process, there is something that is needed, and it's not here. It's the knowledge of the environment. And you know, from the very old Islamic tradition, all the scholars were saying, for a mujtahid, for a mufti, the one who is just coming with fatawa, legal decisions or legal answers to specific problem, there is one condition: know the people and know the environment. So the problem is that you have to integrate into the Islamic knowledge or Islamic sciences the knowledge of the environment. And the problem we have now is that in all the schools of thought within the Islamic communities, the knowledge of the environment is not structured, is not something which is perceived as essential. So you go to some mosque, you know, to some Islamic schools, for example, or even where we are training imams, and you listen to what do you know and what do you say about the British environment or the European history? Nothing. For people who went through 4 years to become Muslim scholars in one French institution in they had only the last year 15 hours of Western philosophy. What's that? How can you deal consistently with a new environment when you don't integrate in this environment, in this education, the knowledge of the environment you are living in? So the British history is part of you. The British psychology, the collective psychology is part of you. It's not only a question of language. When you listen to some politicians say, you have to know English to be an imam in this country. It's not wrong. You have to know English to be an imam in this country, of course, because you are dealing in English. But it's not only this, because you can say very bad things in English. You know, it's not a question of language. You need to know the culture. You need to say to the English people in English that these people are potential enemies. It's much more dangerous to say it in Urdu when the people don't understand what you are saying. So sometimes it's more dangerous when your mind is there and the language is here. We need minds and feelings and hearts here. So the problem is to know about the British history, the collective psychology, the way the people are living. And this should be integrated in our Islamic education. If we are serious and consistent and fair with the fact that the British culture is not per se against Islam, but this is ours now. And everything should be promoted in that way. Coming from that, this is a positive perception. And you understand, it's a very positive. We need to change the mindset. It's really here that we have the problem, the mindset, the way you look and to integrate. So I'm saying, for example, one of the solutions for to deal with extremism in this country is in the mainstream school system to say something about, to give value to the people in this country coming from Pakistan or coming from Bangladesh or coming from Turkey or coming from abroad, that now this country has changed. You have to notice that. You have to know that. British is not, it's no longer the same. It's a new country, it's new people. So in the mainstream school system, we should say something which gives value to the memories, the histories, and the contributions the people are doing. Say something good about my past in order to know that you respect my present. Please, do it in the mainstream. Because if you are not doing it in the mainstream school system, they are going to think about, okay, we need our own schools where we are going to give this, you know, sense of being respected as a Muslim. So this is really important for the mainstream school system. But at the same time, what is really important for the Muslims is when you speak about Islamic education, integrate in the Islamic education something about British culture, collective psychology, history, in order to know for the you Muslims to understand that this is their society, to make it home at the same time. The second is also something which is really important, the practical issue is that if we are serious about universality, you know, I'm here speaking to you and I never feel that I'm speaking about values that you don't share. When I'm speaking about justice, equality, human brotherhood, I think, okay, these are our common values, isn't it? So if I come with this perception of universality on the ground and promoting these values, I get rid of two things on the practical ground, which is really important: the minority mentality and the victim mentality. And when we speak about to get rid of this minority mentality, it's come with speak about the common universal values we share. Not only be obsessed with our differences, but what we share. So now in this country, you are a citizen. And you share the fact that you have to act against all kind of racism, all kind of discriminations, in the name of your common principles, common good, and common value. So act for that. And the point is that many British people were very happy when they say, okay, you know, during the war, the demonstration against the war, we're all together. This was a national movement gathering all the people. This is right. But it's very easy. Very easy. To gather the people against something. But for something, it's very difficult. Against. Oh, I'm against you. Okay, come. Very, very easy. And because, you know, the war in Iraq was a mistake. So it's easy. It was a mistake. Now, as to gather for common values, common good, the future together, it's very difficult. And this is what we need. Why? Because we need on the ground to come all together as citizens against discrimination, against all kind of racism, against all kind of wrong policies and wrong, for example, security policies that are promoting. What is now be dealt with as to the security policies, not only against the Muslims. Be very careful if you think now that these new laws and the new legislation is only going to, you know, to target the Muslims in the future, is undermining human rights of every single citizen in this country. It's a danger for all of us, because this is really the point that we are sharing. So when I'm saying this, from the very beginning, I don't speak as a minority. There is no minority citizenship in Britain. You are a citizen, you are a resident, you speak out of your values. So don't come with this obsession of being a minority. You can be, religiously speaking, a minority. As a citizen, you are part of the majority, and you share the values. And when we speak now about rights, it's really important that you say, okay, we have rights in this country. Don't just isolate yourself and blame the British society, oh, they don't like us. And if you visit the Muslim communities, this is very often the case. They don't like Islam, they don't like us, they hate us, so let us be together and work among ourselves, which is exactly the opposite that you have to do. In an Islamic society and a rule of law, if you are promoting rights, it's the way you are acting against the victim mentality. You will have what you deserve. If you are passive, you're not going to get your rights. If you just accept discrimination. So it's a question of values, common values, in order to go against the minority mentality, and rights in order to act against or to react or to promote something which is against the victim mentality. So it's all about that we have to do out of this understanding against, and to come to something, and this is the third point, which is the common goods. We need civic education. We need civic education. But to tell you the truth, not only for Muslims. Really, this is a common, liability that we have. We don't know about, we are not interested in politics. We are very far from understanding the civil society. We need an active and dynamic civil society. So we need something which is promotion of civic education altogether, not only for Muslims, but altogether, and to share this. We need to reach out. And when, we are speaking, as I told you, about multiculturalism, be careful. I agree with the French people. This is the only one agreement I can have. No, not seriously. There is something that they are right by saying, look, the British model of multiculturalism, it's a problem. And they're right on that. I'm not against multiculturalism. I'm promoting the idea of an active multiculturalism, interactive. But the way we are living now is just a patchwork of communities that don't know each other. They are not reaching out. And many people, when I say that, and among them, the British indigenous citizens, say, yes, you are right. Because in their mind, they are thinking about these Muslims that are segregated. But let me tell you something. What about you? What about the British white people segregated at the same time, their own reality? They are not reaching out. We are exactly promoting the same mentality among my own people. And don't disturb me. What we need now is to come to reach out, to know each other, to mix. And we need a social policy on that. So it's really important not to self-segregate yourself, but also to understand that it's the easiest way. And when you are under pressure, it's the easiest way to say, okay, let me be with my fellow Muslims, or let me be with my fellow British citizens, and I don't want to share anything with the others. So it's very dangerous, and I really think that we have to work on that to promote something which is common citizenship in the name of common goods, and to share a civic, more dynamic civic education, and to also understand on that field that we need to promote something which is a much more a deep understanding of what politics is all about. I have a problem, and to tell you the truth, when the French are saying that very often about the English society, but the British society, but we have also problems in other societies in Europe, and in France, for example, we don't have ethnical ghettos, but we have social ghettos where the people who have modest backgrounds are all together exactly in the same way. The suburbs is exactly the same reality. So the problem is, don't compare and say, okay, my model is better than yours, but every model has its own, assets and liabilities. So I really think that this comparison is just useless. So the point for me is to come to something which is, when we deal with this reality at the political ground, we say that the public sphere is neutral. That here we are dealing with values, principles, and we are not promoting our religious agenda, isn't it? This is what we say. But the problem is that now we have something which is an alienation in our perception of, the way we deal with politics. I heard so many Muslims saying that we need our representative people in the elected people in the political arena. Have a point here. Are we electing politicians because we think that they are promoting the three main values, that they are competent, that they are upright, and they are accountable towards the citizens? Or are you electing people representing the Muslims, the Christians, and the lobby groups? If this is the future of politics in this country, we are undermining the unity of the country. It's not going to work. This is the wrong way. So don't speak about secularism and accept a system promoting something which is, we are promoting our representatives. So you are a Muslim, isn't it? So you are representing Muslims. No, you are not. The one who is representing me, I'm going to elect, is not the Muslim, because it's not clear and it's not obvious that all the Muslims who are trying to be elected are competent, upright, and accountable. And it's not clear that all the non-Muslims are not. So the problem is stick to your principles. You belong to your principles, not to a community that you are promoting right or wrong. So if we accept that, and very often implicitly we are accepting this wrong way to deal with politics, we are undermining something which is we are promoting common good and common principles and just promoting the agenda of my minority, my community, and I think that this is wrong. So to end with that, and this is what we have to promote, we have also to do with something which is essential. The domestic policy with the international scene is going, you know, now that Europe has changed, the Islamic majority society have changed, of course that what is going on the international level will have an impact. So when Tony Blair said there is no relationship between what is going on in Iraq and what is going on, what was done in London, on the ethical ground, he's right. Nothing can justify the killing of innocent people, whatever is done in Iraq. Ethically speaking, he's right. No relationship. It's not acceptable, ethically speaking, to make a connection. But on the political ground, he's wrong. Of course, there is a relationship. Of course, and it was said last year by ministers and reports that be careful, what we are doing in Iraq will have an impact here. Of course. So my point here is please come with political answers to political questions. Don't say, okay, these are the Muslims that are reacting like that. No, we need now to listen to the political question the people have. We were millions telling you, don't go there. Don't go in Iraq. So listen to the people. You are ethically right, but politically you have to listen because we are living in democracy. This following of the unilateralist policy, American policy, is not the future of this country. Listen to the people, and not only the Muslim citizens, but the British citizens. I think that this is really important to connect, and what we have to say to the British Muslim, if you want to help the Palestinians, the Chechen, or the Afghani people, or the Iraqi people, or if, and you have also to put this in your mind, if you want to help all the oppressed people, and among them there are the Tibetans, it's not because they are non-Muslims that you have to forget them from your own agenda. The Tibetans are oppressed by a power that we are very silent with them because of the market. So if you want to help these people, there is only one way. Not to kill. Never. Because this is not acceptable and this must be condemned by you as Muslims. But there is only one way. Be informed. Inform the people around you and vote. Be an active citizen in your country. It's not because you haven't succeeded in the last with Iraq that you have to forget. Be an active citizen. Vote. And this is what we have to say to tell the people. Be informed, because you need to be informed about what is going on. And inform the people around you about the oppression and promote that. So out of all this picture, we understand, and this is the conclusion, we understand that there is a great deal of work to be done upstream from the problem on the theoretical ground, rooted in the Islamic tradition. And this is why when the people come to me and tell me, why are you just the first part of your book is all the Islamic tradition is difficult to read? Yes, it's difficult to read because it's a complex issue and it should come from within. So there is the first part rooted in the tradition, and then we come to the second part with the practical answers. And if you are too lazy to come to the deep problems, just come to the superficial practical answers. So this is one thing which is really important. So there is one thing here that it's a very difficult issues, and we have to work upstream. And then we have to work within the theoretical realm, and then to the within the practical fields. And here, this is what I want to tell all the people who are here. We need, within the Muslim community, in the non-Islamic majority countries, a deep faith, if you want to maintain that, and if you want to be a practicing Muslim, it's up to you. This is a question of choice, and we have not to impose anything. You know, this should be clear from the very beginning, and this is what I said in France. It's Islamically wrong to impose on a woman to wear the headscarf. It's against human rights to impose her to take it off. That's it. Leave the people choose. That's it. This is freedom. But we have to be clear on that within the Muslim community, it's a question of choice. So if you want to be a practicing Muslim or you believe in this tradition, so what you have to promote is deep faith but critical mind. Be self-critical about what is done in your community, because there are so many weaknesses, liabilities and wrong things done in the educational field. In all the fields, we have to come to a critical mind. But what I also need from my fellow citizens in Europe, in America, in Canada, in Australia, ask yourself, do you perceive the Muslim presence in your country as only a problem or a possible richness? Don't say yes like this, because sometimes you can say yes with your mind to please me, and your heart is saying no to please you. And this is really an important question. I'm not sure that my fellow citizens have answered this question. A richness, not something I accept, I tolerate. You know, tolerance is a very tricky concept. I tolerate because I cannot do anything else. To respect is just to give me value, that I am a richness. So this is one. The second, that my presence could be a part of your contribution. When the people are asking and obsessed with, you have to integrate, the only thing I'm answering is, I am trying to contribute. Are you ready for that? And if you are ready to respect and to contribute for the contribution of the other, there is only one way. Are you ready to learn? Are you ready to talk? And are you ready to listen? To listen. And not only to my answers to your questions. You know, very often if I come here, I have some questions. I'm listening to your answer. I am respecting you. No. The true respect towards someone is not only to listen to the answers to your questions, is to listen to his or her questions. You know, dealing with philosophy, with life. Listen to my questions. It's the way to respect me, not only to my answers. Because the way I answer my own questions is for you a better way to know me. So are you ready to that? So this is the shared responsibility. Also a critical mind. What is your perception of the other, the Muslims? Richness, contribution, living together, and out of this nurturing each other through questions and answers and encountering and living together, breaking this intellectual ghetto we have, the social ghetto we live in, the cultural ghetto we are promoting, to come together to promote something which is for the future of our society. The non-majority Islamic society are the societies of the Muslims. And this, there is nothing wrong with that, and this is what we have to promote all together. And we need each other to promote this understanding. Thank you.
Time I've been fortunate enough to hear Tariq speak, he sheds new light on the values of Islam and the quest for common good and common principles. And tonight he's also provided an update on the Tebbit's cricket test about whether one can be Muslim and British and even European, and the extent to which multiple identities can be full identities and not diminished by some notion of integration. Tariq is not running away. He will be staying to answer some questions. He's posed some very practical ideas about how to reconcile seemingly conflicting models and values that challenge both Muslims and non-Muslims alike. So I'm sure he'll have generated a great number of questions. In the next sort of 15-20 minutes, I'll try to take as many as I can for Tariq. And I'd ask you to indicate with your by raising your hand, and I'll try and move across the room and the upper floors and the lower floors. And there are microphones, so if you wait for the microphone, and we'll actually start up at the top, with the yellow shirt.
That was a wonderful talk. I have a problem with something. And I wonder if you can help me with it. My heart warmed when you said, I'll integrate everything that is good and everything that is bad, keep it, it's yours. But the question is, what are the boundaries to that choice? Because I apply this own principle in my own life, and if I'm prohibited by the laws of my country from peaceful assembly, then I may engage in civil disobedience. At the same time, there are certain things that people might choose, things which you and I would probably agree are not Islamic, but which other people might think are Islamic. So I guess the question is, where is the boundary?
I think it's a very broad question, and we have to come, you know, in this kind of, when we speak about boundaries, you are right, where are the boundaries? And I think that in every specific situation, if we are speaking about apply ethics, we need to come to every single situation and to try to find, is it, you know, 20 years ago, 25 years ago, some scholars were saying to Muslims, and you know where were the boundaries at that time, you cannot stay in this country, because we can drink alcohol. So the perception is, as the other people are drinking, you cannot stay. And now we have a better understanding, saying that you are not obliged to drink alcohol, so you can stay. So the boundary is the space you are given to choose, for example. Many Muslims have a problem with homosexuality. Where are the boundaries? And we have a very simple answer. According to all the monotheist traditions, you know, the divine plan is not to promote homosexuality. You're not going to promote it. But now, you're not going to promote it because the tradition are not saying, there is no tradition saying that this is the divine plan. But now, when you are dealing with someone who is a woman or a man who is homosexual, the only right answer in Islam is to say, when you live in the common space, is to say, okay, look, I may disagree with what you are doing, but I respect who you are. And he will say exactly the same to you. You are praying five times a day. He doesn't or she doesn't agree with you. But you ask him to respect or her to respect you. So the problem here is to understand deeply the Islamic values in the way we have to implement them. So once again, it's case per case. In every situation, we need a specific answer. And to tell you the truth, I spent 20 years on that when, you know, I started to write to be a European Muslim dealing with fiqh issues. My perception was we have conflicting, you know, issues that we have to solve. And when you come to the deep understanding that the space, the room you have in secular societies and the dynamics within the Islamic tradition, the Islamic legal tradition, you see that it's not so, you know, we don't have so many, you know, conflicting areas. And to tell you the truth, the only one I found at that time was what was said by some reformist scholars about you being involved in the army, saying when you are going to kill Muslims, you cannot be involved. So I'm always taking the example during the Afghani, you know, the war in Afghanistan, where you have citizens, American Muslim citizens, asking the scholars, saying, okay, look, what should I do? Salafi and Saudi imams and leaders say, you can't. No way say you can go, because you cannot go to kill Muslims. And other reformists and other scholars were saying, look, to show that you are loyal to the American country, go, just to show them that you are loyal, a true American, and that you can do that, that you are loyal to the country. And my perception is that both answers are wrong. If I am a true American citizen, I don't have to prove that I am an American citizen out of a war. Do I have to prove? It's something speaking from outside who is telling me, prove that you are. So, and the point is that the only Islamic answer is to say you cannot kill a Muslims, but you can kill a non-Muslims. It's not the right answer. So my point is, stick to the principles. If you think that this war is right and you are an American citizen, you can be involved. But if you think that this is totally wrong, take the example of the Christians and the Muslims during the Vietnam War who said, I cannot do that. It's what we call, and we have it here, the clause of conscience. I can't. Objection of conscience. So it's to stick to the principles, but to say you cannot go because they are Muslims is the end of the deep understanding of the Islamic principles.
Okay. There was a question at the back.
Assalamu alaikum, and hello. Your comment on Islamic principles being universal and on the Islamic model and the detailed rules being historical remind me of a question from the second century of Islam when the Mu'tazila asked, was the Quran created? If the Quran is created, then we can leave the hudud, the jihad, the jilbab behind in the 7th century. The covering of a woman is just for sand if the Quran is just a historical document. If the Quran is eternal, then shouldn't we keep all of the rules? Aren't all of the rules, the model, the detailed rules, aren't they eternal? That's the question.
Yes, it's a good philosophical question because of the Mu'tazila. Let me put it in that way. I think that all the discussion which was put at that time about the creation and non-creation of the Quran is understood in the wrong way today. It has nothing to do with the fact that we can't just think that things are moving out of our reading. It's not that. The creation was the status of the Quran, you know, as to guard Allah and where we were putting the Quran and the status of the Quran. Now, some of the Mu'tazila were even not all promoting the fact that it was created, that they were. So, you know, it's not as simple as that. So the point for me is not when you say that it's created, you can just, you know, move your understanding. And when you say it's not, you will have these traditions. Many scholars thought that the status of the Quran was it was not created, that they were dealing with the Quran out of a very dynamic reading. And my point is this, to answer to your philosophical question through a philosophical window, is this. It's not the question of the source, it's the question of the readers. So you can have the Quran perceived as not created, it's a book, and then deal with it through an understanding that it has been revealed in a historical context. And all the his classical tradition was thinking that, you know, a chef, Ibn Hanbal, who was acting against that, he was dealing with the environment. So he was reading. So the question is the reader. If the reader has a dogmatic approach, he can change the text towards something which is not immutable per se, and not understanding that you have to take it out of a specific context. It has nothing to do with creation and non-creation. So, look, many Marxists, they never said that The Capital was an uncreated book, isn't it? They never. We had no discussion about the creation, no, of the Capital of Karl Marx. But some were reading it out of a very dogmatic approach. So the problem is in the reader. So it's not in the source. So if you have a mindset and you think that it's a created book, but you have a dogmatic rationalist approach, you can be as dogmatic as someone who is saying it's an uncreated book and reading it in that way. But you can't think that it's an uncreated book, but understand that you have to take the context into account and to come with new and innovative answers for our time. And you don't challenge the status of the Quran. So I think it's a wrong question and which created wrong disputes among Muslims. And I really think that what we have to say is be critical with the readers and the readings, and don't put the Quran in the middle of the discussion, because we are losing the people and the text.
Okay, I know that there are a lot of people that wish to speak. I'm going to do is there's a man in the blue here, then on the end there, and a woman at the back in green. I'll take those questions, and then we'll see how much time we've got.
Thank you. Good evening, everyone. Basically, these are not questions, just quick comment. One of the biggest problems I see as a Muslim, British Muslim, living in England for 17 years, is the, and I work mainly with British, white, non-Muslim in investment banking. There is a valid point that they make, which is, as Muslims, we feel superior as a religion, as Muslims, and that we have the truth in capital letters. At times, I do feel their pain. Just because you're a Muslim, and I'm a Muslim, and we believe in certain things, I do understand that non-Muslims see us as almost arrogant, just because you think you're Muslim, it's almost saying, I'm going to go to heaven, and if you're not a Muslim, you're going to go to hell. This is a perception that as Muslims, we need to erase as soon as possible, because that's not true. We don't know who's going to go to hell or heaven, whether you're Muslim or non-Muslim. Second point is about imams at media and PR. Our imams in this country leave a lot to be desired. They need education. We need to stop, for God's sake, those imams coming on TV, because most of the time they have no idea about political environment issues, the culture. They do more harm to Islam, and therefore I pray and hope that one day we'll have one voice, that any non-Muslim who wants an answer, they go to the source, I don't know, some sort of Vatican for Muslims, one person that can talk. And the last point, and this is for white, quickly, for English, white, or French, non-Muslim. I have been living here for 17 years, and I must say, and I work in investment banking, it's easier to make friends if you are going to go to the pub and drink with them, but I did find that it is harder to make friends, real friendships, with English people in general. It could be just my case, I'm not saying, yeah? But, you know, there was a time I used to drink alcohol and I used to go to the pub. Somehow, maybe the alcohol used to play tricks. I used to think, they're my friends. Well, it turned out that if you're not going to the pub, you have no friends. Thank you.
Okay. We'll take the other two comments as well, and then Tariq will respond.
My question is more to do with the third point you made that I think was the most important, that whatever answers are given to our problems, contemporary problems here in Britain or Europe or whatever else, have to come from within the Islamic tradition. Now, to this, as I'm both a student of Islamic sciences and I'm actually lecturing here in London for what will be this next year in Usul al-Fiqh. And basically, your whole of your discussion to me was basically a reminder of my lessons of Usul al-Fiqh. I don't, as you said, there is nothing new, really. It's basic Usul al-Fiqh. What we're lacking is Usuliyun. What we're lacking is Mujtahidun. And that happened basically because of a historical problem initiated by Muslims with the closing of the gate of Ijtihad, and now the irresponsible opening of the gate of Ijtihad, whereby we're opening it and every team and doc and whoever thinks that he has a bit of knowledge of Fiqh feels that he's a faqih. And I really wonder, in your scheme of things, what role do you think or you place for the mujtahideen? Because at the end of the day, with all the respect I have for you, you're at the end of the day, as you have said in other conferences I heard you speak at, you are an academic. But then these sort of problems are things that will be left to those who are specialists in Islamic law and in Islamic things, who are the fuqaha. And unfortunately, it's difficult now to identify for most Muslims who is a faqih, who speaks with authority as an alim, and who is just a turban with a long beard, basically a shopkeeper, nothing else.
Okay, and at the back there.
Ever since I started to become good friends with Muslims some years ago, I've been wanting to hear an account of Islam that put the theoretical side to a feeling I always had from them, that there was this universality underlying it. There was, I had from them always this sort of intuitive, emotional feeling. There was this commonness that I think you were talking about throughout your talk. And now I've heard it from you, finally, something that as a Westerner, a Western woman, I'm fully comfortable with and makes sense and can relate to. So thank you. That's fantastic. However, it is something, as you said yourself several times, an account which is very psychological and highly theoretical. And I understand that you've been invited to join the government's task force on extremism. Is that right?
Yes.
Just wanted to check my facts there. So I'm wondering how on earth you're going to get all that across to the politicians in a form which they can actually use and do something with once they start to put it out into the arena of policy. And I'd also be particularly interested to hear some more about what you said about developing a social policy for communities in this country to really start talking to each other.
So, some very simple, straightforward questions.
Yes, about your remarks, very, very quick things. I think that you're right when you are dealing with very often from within the Muslim communities, the feeling is that, yes, we have problems, we have
So there is something which is contradictory attitudes. Very often, yeah, they don't like us. They don't. So we are trying to protect ourselves, but at the same time, as when we are dealing with religion, it's as if we know and they don't, and we are obsessed about our, you know, destiny and their destiny. And I think that there is only one thing that we have to come to something which is the essential teaching of the Quran, that God wants this diversity in order for us to be humble, full of humility, and to try to be just to listen to the people and to take from them what is good and to try to be better out of our relationship to them. This diversity is wanted by the Creator. And as to where the people are going, there is only one thing that the Muslim should say. Allahu A'lam, as we say in Arabic, God knows best. I don't know. You know, sometimes someone came to me, a young Muslim, saying, where is now Mother Teresa? Is she, in paradise or... Say. Okay, look. I don't know. And the only answer is that Allahu A'lam, God knows best. I even don't know where I'm going to be. So I'm asking our Mother Teresa, I'm just trying to find my place. So this is, this humility is something that we have. And you are right, this is kind of spiritual education. You humble... relationship you should have with the truth. You can, and this is something that we have to, really the spiritual discussion here. And it's not only, it's something that we have to listen to at the academic level, with Muslims trying to use their mind. You can be someone who never doubt of God, but always doubt of yourself. That's it. And don't confuse the two. Okay, I think that this is the best way to avoid arrogance. No, I don't agree with you. I will never hope that we will have only one voice and a clergy. You are right in one way. We are going through something I call a crisis of authority. Authority crisis. We don't have an authoritative voice. And I think that it's for us, in every new specific environment, to try to gather the people to have kinds of platforms, to have different voices, and trying to, there is something which is an accepted diversity in Islam, an accepted diversity. The problem is that as there is a lack of intra-community dialogue, we don't sit together and we don't talk. So I think that we need a platform of different voices of people sharing this, that there are essentials that are to be respected, and there are things that are not only non-Islamic but anti-Islamic. For example, the attacks in London, they are anti-Islamic, not only non-Islamic. And we have to say that. And that we have to open the floor to this kind of intra-community discussion about many things, not only that, but many things. And this is, we are not doing that. So but to tell you the truth, this is also one of my perception that our presence in the Western society, the European governments should understand that they can facilitate the process for these platforms to arise and to be set. But there is a difference between controlling and facilitating. What we need is governments facilitating the process and not controlling it. Controlling it is not going to work. So as to your... longing for friendship outside the pubs. I think that it's a reality that it's something which is part of the British culture. But I think that there are many other places where it's possible. But what I implicitly hear is to ask our fellow citizens. Okay, look, to live together. Takes efforts. You have also to understand that you have to go outside your intellectual, cultural, social own ghetto and ghettoization, and this sectarianist, approach of your own society should be challenged as well. And this is it. As to the usul al-fiqh, there are many things that I have no time to come to this, and you can be be an academic and at the same time specialize yourself in a solid field, isn't it? It's not a contradictory... No. Is it? It's not.
I have studied and I have
Okay, that's it. Okay, that's good. And to tell you the truth, okay, me too. but and I don't. I'm not looking for that. And I don't think that, to tell you the truth, it's part of the Islamic tradition to wear a turban. But okay, we may disagree on that. But the point here is that yes, for years, I have been studying that. The usul al-fiqh, not the fiqh. You know why? Because I really think that the problem is not in the fiqh answers. And I wrote a foreword for what was done by the European Council of Research and Fatawa. I wrote the foreword of that, saying, "Look, it's a good first step, but it by no means it's the final answer." You know why? Because out of the fiqh approach, we are always dealing with minorities and adaptation, darura, it's a necessity, it's an imperative, and I think that we have to come to the roots. So I'm preparing now a booklet on that, on usul al-fiqh, but not to come with old ideas. It's to come with something which is present in the Islamic tradition but was forgotten through centuries, is the place of the environment in the way we are dealing with the text, so to put the context at the same level. So it's a reform towards the usul al-fiqh approach. So I think that I'm trying. You know, I'm not saying that, I'm just, my position out of what I'm doing is to come with, you know, ideas and proposals, and I put them as questions to the people maybe you recognize as scholars. And if we can work together, let me ask the questions and try with them to come with the answers. Okay, this is as humble as that. I think that this is what I'm trying to do. But to study that is for me essential. All that is coming from this study. All that from two studies, to tell you the truth, is the texts and to be connected with the communities and to listen to the questions we have, understanding that here we have problems in the way we connect our answers with the tradition. And the last, and I think that you are right, the crisis here is also central. And as to the task force, you know, I heard so many criticisms coming from Muslims saying, what is he doing there? It's just strange as we have to deal with emotions in this Muslim community. When you are banned from the States, you are a hero. And when you deal with the British government, you are a betrayer. So I think that both are wrong. And this is why I am speaking about critical mind. I will always sit with any government, any official, any politician, to listen and to come with, to provide some proposals. And what you said is what I understood from the beginning, is to be involved in the process and to come with something for me which is really essential. From the very beginning I said something when, you know, we heard after July the 7th that these people are coming from the Muslim community and the Muslim community should find a solution. I said no. These young born British Muslims are the children of two parents. One is the Muslim community and the other is the British society. And when within a family you have someone, a child who is going astray, it's not the fault. You cannot blame only the mother or the father. Both are responsible. So we have shared responsibility. So here we need, and this is what I'm trying to say, I'm trying to do even, you know, by dealing with the Muslim communities, is to come with this critical mind, is to say, what are we doing as to the Islamic education we are providing, this self-segregation that we are providing, all that we have to say, and we need to acknowledge that we have problems. At the same time, it's really important to ask, and this is what I'm trying, and my contribution is not only, you know, because we are within this task force to lose your critical mind and just to blindly support the British current policy, the domestic or the international, is to say, okay, look, you have, and we have to speak about what I said, you know, the education. What do we say about Islam, Muslims, Pakistani culture, other culture in the mainstream school system? What is it said? How could we give value? We have to change that and we have to think about it. The second is social policy. We need people to mix. We need people to reach out. So what are you providing? What are you doing in that to promote a better living together out of, you know, any kind of policy acting against discriminations and any kind of discriminations and security policy, for example. And the third field is about international policy. As I said, it's really important to connect this with that and to understand that what you are doing there will have an impact on that, and you need political answer to political questions. So we need that. And at the same time, as part of this process, I say my contribution is to come with that and to say something that the British model of multiculturalism will not survive if we remain as we are now. This is one. The second is, yes, we need a security policy, but don't come with new laws that are undermining our civil rights. So I really think that this is a challenge. And you know, I was 10 or 12 years ago, I was here, and I was speaking about some of the leaders who were just spreading hatred and spreading, you know, the fact that you can kill someone. And say, okay, look, the British law should prevent these people to speak like that. We had the laws at that time. We did nothing at that time. We let them speak. And this was undermining the Muslim community because the perception was very bad, and at the same time, the British society altogether. So now we are coming with a new set of new laws saying this is the way. And I think that we are here targeting and acting in the wrong way, and this is very dangerous. And I was critical towards some of these leaders and imams. But as a European citizen, I will never support a policy telling us that we are going to speak with dictators, have their word that they are not going to torture people and to send our people or these people there to be tortured. This is not a right policy. And I'm happy that the EU, the European Union is saying to the British government, don't go that way. It's not right. Don't trust the dictators. They say today that they are not going to torture, and they are going to torture. You know, I want you to know something. I was very critical towards the Egyptian government because in 1994, because it was not a democratic society, and it was not. I was there arrested when I arrived in Egypt at that time in 1994, and at that time I was very critical, saying this is not a democratic country, and I will always speak from where I am against the regime because it's not a democratic country. You know what happened? They took me for 18 hours, and I had a Swiss passport. They don't touch me. But they took an Egyptian in front of me, and they beat him just in front of me. I will never forget that because my passport protected me. And now we will take these imams and send them there. All together, we have to say no. It's not our values. It's not our way to deal with any kind of terrorist threat. And I really think that this is our responsibility as European citizens, or British citizens today, to this government. Yes, we need a security policy, but not at any price.
Okay, we were late starting, so although we're overrunning, I'm just going to take a last round. I will ask people to be very quick and to be brief. I know people have to go. There are two people that have already indicated up there and in the corner there. If there are any women that would like to, there's a woman up there with, at the front. So we'll take those last final comments. I should just let you know that there will also be a press conference with Tariq in the Vera Anstey room as soon as we've finished here, which hopefully will be in the next 5 or 10 minutes. So let's take those questions. So the gentleman and the end, the man at the end.
No. Should I start?
Yeah.
Your talk was very cozy. I mean, it was interesting to hear a very theoretical, as was said, psychological perspective. But when you put things like geopolitics, political bankruptcy, and things like Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo Bay in this, it becomes very complex indeed. And this whole place of finding a commonplace of having a discourse becomes even more difficult, I would say, because it becomes more divisive to live together in non-Islamic societies for Muslims. So I'm not really sure. I'm not that hopeful or optimistic about having such a utopia as you constructed for there to be a fora. If that was the case, then basically Socrates would not have died in vain. Thank you.
And the woman at the front there.
is it on? Okay. Thank you for your talk. I think you dismissed the pub issue a while back, but I think it's actually quite an important issue practically because you looked at the theoretical side of things. Even if me as a Muslim woman, for example, I adopt that idea of integrating the ideas of this country, how do I actually make a rapprochement between my non-Muslim citizens when they're looking at me thinking, she can't speak English, they're not going to approach me, and I can't actually interact in their social forum, which is based around alcohol. And I think for me that's been a real problem because personally I'm ready to interact, I'm ready to discuss, but what do? Speak really loudly on the mobile phone so that they know I can speak English. So how do you actually get that impression across that you're ready to discuss, approach me, without looking like you want to convert them and approaching them?
And the last point just there, and the third row up.
Do you think in the long run your philosophical discourse will have more resonance for an ordinary Muslim than more literalist interpretations? Because I think as long as you stay within the Islamic sphere and there's no higher doubt, so to speak, the literalist will always have winning arguments. And how do you relate to the ordinary person as opposed to the more educated person, which I think you're aiming at, but who aren't necessarily the majority? Thank you.
You know, it's not... I'm optimistic in one way, and you're right. You know, I spend much of my time connected to the communities, on the ground, with people. And I'm speaking about the silent revolution in the way the Muslims are thinking of themselves and they're dealing with the society. The point you mentioned about Al-Raib or Guantanamo, I think that, yes, if you look at that and say, okay, how you know, governments can deal and do that, and you think that it's them versus me, you are nurturing this binary vision. The point for me is that it's exactly the opposite that we have to do. And it's here that you have to come to the common ground with your fellow citizens, because the great majority of your fellow citizens were just shocked and they didn't accept that at all. They were against what happened. So the point here is that if you put us in that, on that, you are wrong and it's not fair with your fellow citizens. The great majority of the citizens in this country were just shocked about what is done there. Guantanamo is, you know, considered by many, many millions of non-Muslims as something that is just shame. It's just nothing that we can support or that we can just accept. So the point here is to go out of our ghettos, to come with these people and say, okay, in the name of our common values, we have to get to act against that. This is not acceptable. What was done in Iraq, in the jails, what is done now in Guantanamo, and many, just even in America. You know, don't never confuse the current American government with the people, even though we can, all the people say, okay, the Americans, they know nothing about nothing. And to tell you the truth, many French think that you British, you know nothing about nothing. So, and sometimes you about the French. So what? This is simplistic, you know, statements. I really think that we have to work with people here in this country having exactly the same perception. And out of this, our common understanding, that we can come to really reach out and work together. And I really think that this is really important. This is really important. Sometimes very bad experiences like this one can help us to come to something which is a common ground for the common good. And my point is that so many people are just sharing our views on that. So I think that we have to refuse to come to this, you know, Abu Ghraib is not a Western project. It's something which is done by a specific administration. It's wrong. If you put the West
as the Guantanamo as the symbol of the Western policy, you are unfair. Because if the people are looking at some of our Islamic majority countries and say, okay, what is done there is Islam, take Saudi Arabia, you will not be happy. I'm not. And I think that we have very, very, to be very cautious on that and to be fair with our fellow citizens and to come to the common ground. You said something which is the heart of the problem. And you said it's a question of perceptions. You are right. The people, they look at you and say, okay, maybe she doesn't speak English because of the headscarf. And once we had a meeting with a group in France, and there is one French intellectual who was looking at a woman with a headscarf and said, wow, she's intelligent. But what is he saying implicitly? That he never met a Muslim woman, that he has no idea. So you can just blame him for having this perception, but try to think, okay, I have two choices now, to withdraw into myself and to go out of this society and to do exactly the opposite. The natural way in this bad, you know, the climate of bad neutral perceptions is just to withdraw into yourself, to segregate yourself, say, okay, I have nothing to do with that. This is the natural way, but this is the wrong way. Here, to use the word jihad, effort, perseverance, endurance, is to do exactly the opposite. Go out. Let them understand that you speak English. Let them understand that you are a British citizen, that you have nothing to prove, and that you are here just to share views. Be present to change the perception. And at the local level, we need a national movement of local initiatives coming from Muslims to be present. I'm here. Listen to me, trust me, and if you don't trust me, okay, I will continue. It's my country. So this is what we have to be confident. So this perception, and we are nurtured by these emotions, and I understand that it's difficult. Here, it's the most difficult thing to do. And sometimes ourselves, myself, I'm trapped in that, okay, perception that I have to, you know, I call it the syndrome at the borders. You know, you arrive at the border and say, okay, with the face I have, I'm sure that he's going to arrest me. To stop. And I'm arriving at the border, and because he sees me just having, okay, say, okay, you come here. I'm nurturing his perception, and he do it. So, okay, I'm sure. I was sure that he wants to do that. And he did it. So, but we are nurturing our mutual perceptions. So I really think that we have to change that and to be present. It doesn't mean that you have to go to the pubs and share beer or something like that. Just find places where you feel comfortable and the people are not, they are not always in the pubs. Or maybe yes. Or maybe yes, but I don't think so. Well, I don't know the British society enough to speak about it, but really I think that we have to find other ways and to be. And the last point is there are many levels in the way you are dealing with the Muslim community. And they are, you know, here in universities with, you know, educated people, and you are dealing with the community, the average Muslims, and here are the ordinary people. And we need a specific, you know, approach and speech and terminology for all of them, going from the practical, you know, problems to a more, you know, intellectual approach. So my point is always to be connected to what we at the grassroots with the average Muslim. So to speak to students, to speak to the people who can just have the terminology and can convey a better understanding, and then to be in touch with the people. So here it's really important to come with very practical answer, to listen to people, and to come to very, 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 you know, important approach, new approach, but dealing with the reality. So the point here is that it's not easy, and it takes time. You never change mentalities overnight. It takes time. And the people around, very often, I'm asking my fellow citizens, look, you have to decenter yourself from your own perception. You have to look to understand that, you know, it's what we call in psychology empathy. Empathy. So try to understand what the people are going through, what the people, how they understand, try to understand that it takes time. So this process is really important, but we need to do it at different level. And very often, at the grassroots level, it's through projects, you know, not discourses. It's the way you are involving the people in the society and to promote specific education. And I think that throughout Europe now, this is what we're trying to do. You know, I'm working with a European Muslim network, which is a think tank. We are sharing views, promoting citizenship, a better understanding. And we are working, and this is one of the essential things I'm promoting. Work at the academic level, but never, never disconnect yourself from the people. Never. You must understand that at that time, it's a very difficult time, you should serve the people through your academic work, and not just hope that they are going to respect your work. And I really think that this is something which is missing within academia. Many Muslim scholars are speaking, but they are totally disconnected. They are not heard by the Muslims. And I think that it's good, because sometimes they please the West by saying exactly what the West wants to listen to or to hear, but they are not promoting a true dialogue. I call it an interactive monologue. So you are dealing with the people who are saying exactly what you want to see, what you want to listen to. So I think that promote a dialogue with the communities, and it's that easy.
Okay, it's been a scintillating evening, and I hope that those concerned that Islam and secular values cannot easily coexist will leave tonight feeling more hopeful and optimistic about prospects for reconciliation. Tariq has, with his insight and vision and his deep faith but critical mind, he's marked himself out as a rare mediator between seemingly conflicting worlds. I'm very grateful for the inspiration he shared with us this evening, and I ask you to join me in showing our appreciation to him. A press conference now in the Vera Anstey room, and Jeff and his team have asked me just also to mention that next week on Tuesday there will be a lecture by Arnie Hochschild on capitalism and the intimate life, so you are welcome to join us then. Thank you.